And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, just in time, live from the future. And my very special guest, who's also just in time, is Liam Sheff. Liam, welcome to the program.
Hi, so good to be back on. Thank you very much for having me.
Had you been 60 seconds later, you wouldn't have been able to join me on the first segment, maybe.
That's amazing.
You're like, oh yeah, just slotting in right there, you know, like when you're driving on the highway in a manual car and you're kind of, it's so much easier to shift gears and get it right up there when it all goes in straight like that. It's fantastic.
I apologize. I was, I stopped. I take a 6.5 mile and 6.5 mile. I'm out in sort of the boondocks in Central Florida right now. And I go out to the local mall, to the supermarket. It's 6.5 miles away. And I got talking to, I haven't seen a homeless couple for a while because I don't live in a city anymore. But I saw a homeless couple. They were in their 30s. And I talked to them for a while about joining WOOF, a worldwide organization of organic farms, and about, you know, sort of getting off the beaten path. I bought them some avocados. Anyway, we had a good conversation. And then I biked back leisurely and I thought it was 9:30. And that's what happened. And I'm sticking with that story.
It's a good story. Not sure if I believe it yet. But anyway, you got a new book coming out, bro.
Yes, thank you very much. I have a book. It is out. It is oot. The book is my previous book, which you had me on to talk about. We talked about a lot about AIDS, drugs, and HIV tests. You remember? Was Official Stories. I'm writing more or less a sequel to that now, but I needed something human and light in between darkness. So I wrote a story, and listen, you're kind of a sweetheart to have me on without really knowing all, and I'm not trying to flatter you, but without knowing about all of it.
It's not being a sweetheart, it's being lazy, can't be bothered doing the work beforehand.
You're being a lazy dog to not realize that what I'm going to be talking about is probably going to upset a lot of people.
Well, thank God.
But I've been researching marriage systems, relationship systems for a long time. I've never really felt that I was a monogamous person, but I didn't know what to do about it. I wasn't a swinger and I didn't go to bars and I didn't pick a lot of people up, but I just didn't really understand the notion that if you really care about somebody, that's when you decide to own each other's genitals. You know what I mean? Like, hey, I really like you. Oh, don't never touch anybody else. Never look at anybody else. Never do anything else that I might be upset about.
Yeah. Never dip your chicken nuggets in another woman's sweet and sour sauce.
I forgot that you're funny. Good. So I struggled with this, and I'm 43. When I was 20, I started getting into relationships, and the first thing I said was, I don't know that I'm monogamous. I just don't know what this is. There were no words for it then except slut and whore, which I believe I was called by one of my girlfriends, whore. I didn't feel that was correct because I had always been honest with her that I didn't think I was very monogamous. I didn't go out sleeping with everybody. I just didn't understand the rules. Like, can I care about somebody else? What if we're hanging out and we're at a party, you end up kissing for a minute? Is that against the law? Why? You know, I mean, I'm not going to move in with her. She's a friend. It was just fun. So I put it aside. I tried to do the right Western cultural thing of self-bondage. I became very unhappy, very grumpy, and very moody. That didn't work for me. So I swore off relationships for a couple of minutes. And I made a friend who was my friend and became really my partner. Because she also had the same trouble with the ownership quality of relationships. And we traveled halfway around the world. She was a wonderful soul, really the best person, kindest, most generous person I've ever known. We had 7 years together. This is a little bit tough, but I gave her a kiss one day to go to yoga class. She went to yoga and she had an aneurysm and she left the planet, you know. So that happened, you know. And I was about deadly suicidal for a year. And then I sort of chunked along for another year, and then I didn't really know what to do. Then I wrote Official Stories, and then 2.5 years later, I'm writing about her. And I'm writing about our relationship. And the book might sound now like a sort of emotional romance, but it's a very funny story that asks the question, and it's not quite me, and it's not quite her, but it's pretty close, that asks the question, are we really monogamous? Now, before I wrote this, I got into deep research about marriage systems, cultural inheritance, the Judeo-Christian ethos that binds people together, that's essentially a land-owning agreement. And I came down to a couple of shiny brass tacks, and I will talk about the story, I will talk about those brass tacks, or I'll talk about what I think are the only four stories that are in the media. You tell me. Wind me up, and I will go in whichever direction.
Well, I seriously, just go for your life, son. Don't stand on ceremony.
All right, I see. I am going to do it. This is self-propelled. So my name's Liam Sheff, and I'm a journalist, and I used to work on pharmaceutical issues, and I still do if Facebook doesn't take away my page. Can I do something impromptu? A friend of mine, who is a radio broadcaster, who's a guy who's had me on his show 5 times, had both of his Facebook pages totally stripped away from him without warning, without ceremony, and without recourse, as far as I know. Well, I can tell you what the recourse is, and I won't talk about this the whole show, but this just happened to a friend of mine this afternoon. And Facebook is something that's meant to be a social network for people, and it's turned into a very political network for us to be able to talk about things that we care about and promote ourselves. You use it, I use it, everybody uses it, even though it's CIA and FBI controlled. We know it is. We know that all of the naked pictures that we receive and send are being monitored and collected for a large-scale photo book to be released, you know, whenever we try to go for elected office or something. Yeah.
All the porn sites and everything that you visit are being scrutinized in minute, vivid detail by extremely dedicated, extremely dedicated surveillance agents.
So, do you know I'm on a radio show on Truth Frequency Network, which is a fun network with a lot of fun, crazy, wild-eyed conspiracy stuff and some grounded fun stuff. And it's a good bunch of crazy comedians over there. And Popeye, who runs a show called Down the Rabbit Hole, which is an alternative media institution like yours. But your guys are the smaller, saner Alex Joneses of the world. And I'm glad for that. Because, I don't want to be histrionic and talk about how they're coming to put you in body bags 24 hours a day,
I honestly can't wait, because then I don't have to work at exposing scumbaggery anymore, I can just take a holiday in the grave, Bugger it, man. It's just the end of the world.
You've grown a little darker. I'll just say that. Just a little darker. It's wearing on you, but it's funny. You wear it well.
Well, you don't really have much of a choice in the matter. Like, I just went through some real traumatic stuff with my computer the last couple of days, bro, and it's like, worried that 18 months of work has been deleted or something, and I'm just sitting here going, okay, it's kind of like a grief process. You know how we get emotionally attached to machines now? And I'm just sitting there going, okay, what's the grief process? All right, well, towards the end of the grief process, there's the depression, and then there's finally the acceptance. So I'm just going to jump straight into the depression and hopefully accept that as a reality. I think that kind of clears the playing field.
You're funny. Good. I could use some laughs. But so I don't know if you have any sympathy for we little ones who are shaking the tree in our own way with our own little agendas of trying to figure out what's true, where to live, what to grow. My friend, Popeye, of Down the Rabbit Hole and Truth Frequency Radio, had 2 Facebook pages. One was a personal and one was a show page, stripped. And what they want from him, and I'm serious when I say this, what they want from him, and this is what he told me, what they want from him is no less than a birth certificate to identify. Now, the reason he's called Popeye was because this is his nickname. He's famously 5'5". He was in the military Coast Guard. He did a lot of stuff in that military with guns and on high seas with pirates and that sort of thing. And, it's real stuff that he's been through. He's got the tattoos, the PTSD, and the scars to prove it. So he's had
the
his...
real question is, did he eat cans of spinach?
Anyway, I just want to give a shout out. Now, you can find him on Down the Rabbit Hole, and just go look at him on Down the Rabbit Hole and federaljack.com. So back to... And I mean that. That really did happen. I'm plugging for a friend here. Now, plugging for this friend, I wrote a book called Official Stories, and I wrote it because, in many ways, because I didn't know how, I was 30, I had just turned, what am I now, 43? I was turning 40. And I thought that that was as good a time as any to make a mark. I had lost the best friend that I'd ever had, a partner of 7 years, someone who I'd lived and traveled with, was, loving and intimate with, and who knew everything about me, everything. We had essentially an open, communicative, open relationship. that was a struggle at times to understand because we didn't have a guidebook. We were incredibly generous and sweet with each other. She was always more generous with me than any human being had ever been. She was a children's librarian. She read stories to kids, and she made it possible for me to do the work that I did. And I didn't say this when she was around because I didn't want to implicate her. You know, she was just working as a librarian. But she made it possible as an emotional support, as a co-house, you know, runner to do the work I did in exposing the AIDS pharma cabal, which was using children in New York in clinical trials and really killing them. So she's an unsung hero, excuse me.
Technically, she's also an unhung hero because we've got nothing to wing. But
that's very sweet. And she remembers she's passed on, so that it's a really tasteful joke. And I want your audience to write you hate mail now. So she's an unsung hero, and she's now sung. And she's sung in a book called The Truth About Love, a novel about finding your more than one, which is 99 cents for 3 days on ebook. 99 cents on ebook. It's called The Truth About Love, a novel about finding your more than one. I will send you the American Amazon thing, but it's on Amazon Europe, Amazon Australia. And is there an Amazon NZ? I don't know.
No, yeah, I think that basically it's all just internationalized now. Anybody can sell anything on Amazon and then just ship it wherever the heck.
Well,
and considering you're only paying 99 cents and you don't even have to actually ship anything and it's just a downloadable electronic book version of it, I don't think that matters either.
Right. And the reviews are really warm. This is a very sexy book. It's also a very honest book. I was told that the conversation between the young men, myself, really a clear version of myself and other friends that I had, are the most honest conversations that they've ever heard spoken. They're not that sort of guttural slang thing. It's just actually the way that we talk when we're with our good friends and we let it all hang out. There's another hanging joke. That's 3, 2. So I wrote this, but what I was intending to write was a nonfiction book about oil decline, non-monogamy, and tribalism. And I got really far. I have all the chapters mapped out. I had some of them completely written. I had all of them written to some degree. And I kept looking at it, and I kept going through it. And I knew that the information was good. I knew that I was talking about the Maasai and the Inuit and the Kiri, I think, in the Trobriand Islands. I was talking about various, the Zoe in South America. I was, you know, I was talking about all these tribes all over the world. Then I was talking about the American fake monogamy system. And in the American fake monogamy system, we're essentially a tribe that depends on Tony Soprano, Don Draper, The Bachelorette. We go into our little stucco boxes at night, our formaldehyde and stucco and petrol boxes, and we turn on a fake community of people who live in either New York or Hollywood, who somehow their dream is to pretend to be other things on television. That was their dream, and they're achieving it, and we watch them, and we watch them have sex inside and outside of their fake relationships, and we tell ourselves that we're monogamous, Christian. I'm neither of those. I'm openly neither of those. But this is what people live under. And the total hypocrisy of the American system began to come into great focus for me. I read 16 books, you know, starting with Christopher Ryan and Casilda Jatha's Sex at Dawn. And, you know, theirs is an imperfect but a very good book, The Myth of Monogamy by Barash and Lipton, which is really an overly long treaties on how animals aren't monogamous, but maybe we should just try to be. And we're not monogamous, but maybe we should just try to be. I read the Helen Fisher book, who's had a TED talk in which she tries to explain why we're not monogamous, but we really have to try to be. I read better books like a Paleo History of Love. I can't remember what it's called, but an early, you know, something like that, which was a much more interesting book. And I'm butchering it because I don't have the title. I read Sex and Punishment, which is an absolute must-read for people who want to understand the Judeo-Christian herding culture legacy that we have and how we bound ourselves from being...
I don't know about you, but I've gotten married recently and I've started to realize that sex and punishment are almost identical.
Yeah, you're funny.
I love making wife jokes. It's great, man. Oh my god! It was. I mean, that's the best part about getting married is being able to make wife jokes and marriage jokes and things like that. Have you noticed in pop culture, Liam, that all of the TV shows and sitcoms and everything, there's huge amounts of jokes about marriage and how bad it is and everything, and there's very, very few examples of monogamous relationship couples that are raising their kids well.
Right, but I think that that's almost true. Because, I mean, I've lived in all kinds of families. I grew up in a very broken, divided set of relationships, you know. And so I got to spend time in sort of every socioeconomic group. And I mean, really poor kids, you know, and really rich kids. And I got to go to camp where I cleaned horses and cleaned their hooves and shoveled shit and picked up snakes.
We can't say the SHIT word on
really?
FCC regulation radio. Yeah.
I didn't realize I was on FCC.
Well, we may or we may not be. However, I do have a lot of syndicators on different networks around the world.
I apologize. Let's roll on and I'll watch myself.
Exactly. Have you ever noticed that when you stop somebody to talk about whatever it was they were talking about when it didn't really matter and maybe nobody even cared that there was a swear word in the first place, you interrupt their train of thought, and then you go to commercial, as we're about to do. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Sorry,
broadcasting on American FreedomRadio.com 4 days a week. My very special guest is Liam Sheff. That's SCHEFF. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about being a slave of the system. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with the theme song music that just doesn't stop. Or go away. Oh, there it goes. My very special guest is Liam Sheff, talking about his new book. Give us the title again, please, brother.
Yeah, you know, we had a buzz on the break, and I have a buzz. I'm just going to tell you now, and we'll just keep going.
I'm going to be getting the beers out of the fridge during the next air break, like, seriously.
Yeah, well, if you want to reconnect, let me know, because I'm having a loud buzz. So,
that buzz is actually supposed to be there. We're just kind of like, I don't know, sitting out the stuff. But anyway, let's pretend like it's not happening, okay? Like when your missus sleeps with other men.
Right. Well, that was the hard part to get over. When as a guy, you think, well, this will be fine. You know, I get to hug and kiss her a little bit. I mean, I've never really been somebody who easily slept with everybody, but I was always sort of a kissy slut, you know. It was fun, you know, these things happen sometimes. Just the idea that you get into a relationship and that would be it was difficult for me. I tried to hold myself to it, I became unbearable, and I became even more jealous. When I didn't hold myself to it, I was much less jealous, which is kind of interesting. It's almost a projected jealousy, right? You're resentful that you're making yourself do something that you don't want to do, so you're even more upset if somebody else does it.
Well, I've been saying for a long time, never underestimate a man's ability to play mind games with himself and win.
That's really funny. Okay, I agree. I think that everybody plays mind games with themselves. In official stories, I talked in chapters 5 and 6 about the HPV fake vaccine for the fake thing that doesn't cause cancer, and the HIV fake test for something that they don't diagnose, and then they give you drugs that are incredibly toxic that will kill you. These, to me, are modern versions of Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter, but really of the old Judeo-Levitical, I don't know, you're not supposed to, the thou shalt's and thou shalt not's, you know, the Levitical prohibitions against, the Levitical prohibition against laying with, hugging with. Leviticus was written, I'm not quite, I'm going to get it wrong, in the 800s, 700s, something like that. It's probably around there. When the northern Jewish tribe was sort of on the way back from being imprisoned in one of the Persian states at the time. These are the laws of a herding culture that drives animals. Now, the book that I was going to write, which I may not write anymore because I think that it's already out there in the zeitgeist, But that was going to talk about, it's talked about a little in Sex at Dawn, but I was going to expand the idea that we come from a foraging species. We're about give or take, whatever you believe the numbers are worth, we're about a 300,000-year-old species. And the things that looked like us a little bit that came before us are several million years before that. And we were a foraging species, which meant that we lived in a little area and we picked the things that we could find and ate a lot of grasshoppers and ants and little honey bugs that, you know, stored sugar in them. And we ate a lot of little things and fruits and berries and twigs and seeds and anything that was easy to get, we ate. Tiny fish, you know, that sort of thing, salamanders. We, as a human species, wandered through the world in Africa and in probably Asia, parts of Europe, as foragers, living a seasonal existence. And we'd move from place to place, season to season, and gather food. We didn't then accrue great volumes of material. And by the way, if I'm getting some of this wrong, it's okay, just correct it. I wasn't necessarily prepared in my mind to go to all of these dates and the warm up as we go along.
Don't worry, suits in my general thesis that humanity is more or less behaves in much the same way of a plague of locusts, but seasonally, moving to different areas. And
that's how we do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we weren't, but as a small band of foragers, 25, 50 people, you know, in a large band, 100 maybe, you're not really 60. You're not really going to be a plague of locusts. You'll walk through, you'll get what you can get, but you can't eat everything. You'll chase some of the little animals, but you're not really going to be hunting the big dangerous ones. That's a myth. I mean, that didn't happen for a long time. You're going to eat what you can grab, grasshoppers. And grasshoppers are really, you know, multiply by the millions every season. So it's not very hard to feed yourself. They're high protein, high fat. They're everything that you need. They have a lot of minerals. And so grasshoppers are now coming back as a food. Some people are trying to market something called chirps, which I would eat. You know, I don't have any problem eating grasshoppers. I don't eat cows, but I don't have any problem eating grasshoppers. They're low on the food chain. So we were foraging species. As a foraging species, we didn't gather material. We didn't have houses, and we didn't need to pass on material or objects to our children. All the children in a foraging culture, and there's still foraging tribes all over the world, raise their children in groups. The children are not punished physically. They're not beaten. You can look at some of this in Jared Diamond's work and other anthropologists. They'll tell you that foraging cultures don't whip their kids. They don't berate them. The kids are more or less free to experiment, to be affectionate with each other, play sexual with each other. You know, kids can't have babies, so it doesn't really matter. They just, it's kid world. You leave them alone, they do their thing. Adults do other things, and adults in foraging cultures forage and build little things and build shelters and decorate themselves and pick things that are drugs and take the drugs and have ceremonies and see the goddess and the god and the forest and the trees and the sky, and that's life. And every once in a while you go hunting for some monkeys or a little forest animal with the spear that you make, and it's a small animal and it's not dangerous, and then you provide a little extra fat and protein, and that's what you do. And that's life forever. There's really nothing else. You dance, you see the sky, you paint each other, you get old, you raise kids. Individuals don't raise kids in foraging cultures. The group is responsible for the kids. So the idea that you two foragers, would move into a hut, close it off to other people, turn on the television, watch Don Draper having sex with people, wouldn't make any sense at all. You live in essentially a large open community. The kids come and go. When it's time to indoctrinate the 13, 14, 15-year-olds into coming-of-age ceremonies, the older guys do it for the guys, and the older girls do it for the girls. When it's time to come to terms with sexuality, younger teenagers will be brought through training, like in the Mangaia tribe in the Cook Islands. They'll be brought through training in how to be better at sex. They're given rules, and even the Maasai tribe, which is a rather more sadistic herding culture, a more punitive, I should say, herding culture, even they have a kind of bacchanalian thing for the teenagers who are coming of age so that they can sow all their wild oats for a while. So we're a very sexual species. There's a cutoff point in all herding tribes at the point before which you can have babies and the point after which you can have, you know, before which you can and after which you can. So children are always separated, so there's no real notion of like people hurting kids. There's no reason, you know, there's just no there. Kids are in kid world, and then everybody above a certain age within a peer range is in their world. And you would never tell in a in a foraging tribe or even a herding culture that if you couldn't tell a 15-year-old that she was too young to have sex, she's supposed to start breeding. So that's the difference in tribal life, where it's much more biologically oriented. Now, you can ask yourself, and I think it's the right question, why, how did we get here? And this is a question that archaeologists, anthropologists will say, it was the dawn of the agricultural age when there became more of us and we sort of got heavier in one area and we gathered things that seemed to produce heavier seeds annually, and those seeds dropped in one place more and more because we picked the heavier ones and those seemed to drop in one place more. So we kept selecting for the heavy, heavy, heavy ones and replanting the heavy ones. So within a short period of inbreeding, we inbred animals. From wild animals, you inbred animals, and they inbred very quickly in a number of generations to very different stubby-legged, docile things that aren't afraid of people the same way. They've done this with wild foxes in Russia. You take these wild, wild animals, you inbreed them for several generations, picking the tamest ones, and they develop wildly, totally different phenotypes, manifested types. They look different. Their ears flop. Their coats change color. Their eyes change color. Their tails curl and get floppy. Their their legs become stubby. They look like dogs.
It sounds almost like dogs themselves. Out of all the infinite breeds, you know, the big ones, the small ones, the spotty ones, the fluffy ones, the roly skinned ones, that kind of thing, and they all descend from wolves, who all are big, stocky, fluffy killing machines, you know.
Killing machines. Wolves are gorgeous, gorgeous creatures the size of small horses. You know, they're not like dogs. I mean, if you've ever seen a wolf, I was working in Jacksonville, Florida, and I would go to the art market. And there was a couple who brought their wolf in, and they had a wolf. And I got to stand next to the wolf, and the wolf liked me. The wolf's snout is as long as your forearm. You know, if the thing wants you, it has you. There's no arguing, you know. It's a very different creature.
Mm. And some people anyway, are like really clearly attuned. Like, interviewed this one guy who used to be in a super soldier program or whatever, and when he got out, the only animals that kind of seemed to understand him very well and hang around a lot were wolves. So he had like three wolves living in his house with him.
Right,
like on his lap like a little baby.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, if you get around these animals, and I suppose you have that right energy that they like, whatever it is, I was lucky that I had it, they'll just press into you, and their hair comes off in giant clumps, and they just keep growing more of it. You know, I wish they would invent that for humans. But anyway, we inbred animals, and we inbred crops. All of our crops, you know, are not wild crops. They're wildly inbred to produce the maximum amount of flesh and fruit to the minimal amount of inedible parts. So we don't really have any kind of natural diet. Even people who eat the wholest, most organic things are eating wildly inbred crops. But that's okay, because we've been doing that forever. All right.
Wildly inbred sounds like a nonviolent extremist.
Wildly inbred, nonviolent extremist. I'm going to have to wait to get that one.
I am totally a wildly inbred, a nonviolent extremist.
So the wildly inbred, nonviolent extremist that we became, the agricultural society did become violent, as opposed to the herding, the foraging cultures that wandered about without possessions. Now, the agricultural civilizations had to sit in one place, and then they would gather food, and they had to store food for the next year in case the harvest was bad. Now, then there were the people who hadn't settled down, and they realized that they could raid the people who were settling down, and so you had to develop armaments and walls, soldiering, military, etc. So you just see the development of the entire, what we think of as the human species in the last 10, 15,000 years, maybe 12,000 years, but we're a 300,000-year-old species. So for 99% of our existence, or there 97% of our existence or thereabouts, we were a much more peaceful, at least we had no real reason to fight with each other very often, foraging species that didn't have patrilineal inheritance, that didn't have any real inheritance except that you were a member of the tribe. And then you might get older and graduate and marry into another tribe. So, you know, people didn't want to inbreed. So there was that natural flow, and that happens still in tribes today.
But it doesn't happen in the Rockefeller or Rothschild families, as far as I know, the not inbreeding thing.
Well, as far as, you know, anybody can tell, cousins, if you're very poor and your cousin is your wife, you're white trash. But if you're very wealthy and your cousin is your wife, then you're the king of England.
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much.
You know, so you've got to love Hereditary Inbred Dictators. It's got a nice ring to it.
Hereditary Inbred, HID. Yeah, it's like a disease.
Like our country has HID, Hereditary Inbred Dictators.
Who's going to be the president of this ridiculous corporation of America? I mean, you already...
Somebody related to another president of America, or probably somebody who's related to all of them. Considering they're all currently related, some 14-year-old girl did a genealogy on the male and female lines, found out that every single president of the United States is frickin' related, traced back to one French king.
Wow.
You can't make this stuff up, bro.
No, that's like Maria Theresa of Spain. She birthed, you know, every monarch of Europe for a while, down to Marie Antoinette. So we still live there. Just in case people... Oh, God. Just in case people think that voting is important, I'd like to disabuse you of that notion. So we started passing down stuff, and then women became property of the household, because the child had to be the property of the man so that he could pass his stuff on to the child. As George Carlin used to say, I need a place for my stuff. And the kid, the first male heir especially, became the possessor of the father's stuff. So women became possession of the man. The man became possession of the... You know, the king or the local official. In other words, that everybody had to kick money up. So the wife was owned by the husband, and the husband was owned by the king. And that's what happened during agriculture. Now, the herding cultures drove animals along. They retained the mobility of a foraging group, but they got into inbreeding animals. Now, foragers could pick up, handfuls of whatever they could find, whether it be grasshoppers or grubworms or nuts and seeds from blooming trees in season, fruits, et cetera, fish. They could find copious amounts of this stuff in any particular season. And if they were in a downtime, they just went to a warmer area.
Well, hold on a second there. We're going to have to go to break. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Liam Schiff. You're listening to the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question in Eastwood, isn't it? Go ahead, make my news. Back in a moment. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment of the first hour of the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com is where you can find the archives and other good stuff there as well. If the music ever goes down, and not playing over the top of me, that is. And my very special guest, who I'll come to in a moment... is Liam Schiff. Now, I also wanted to tell people about the documentary that I'm making. We're having a little bit of computer problems. And when you know that you're having computer problems and computers are your life and your life's work is kind of done on them, when you have problems with it, it's almost like you're losing a loved one, right? Or better yet, you're like, okay, is this going to be solved? Oh, I don't know. Can we do data recovery? I don't know. So it kind of gets a little bit freaky at that particular point. Like you're sitting outside the surgical tent while somebody you love is going under the knife to save their life, and you don't know whether or not they're going to be coming out alive or coming out damaged or whatever. So if anybody can, send me some good vibes and just be like that woo-sah type energy out to me down here in New Zealand, if you close your eyes and do something fantastic or whatever, and just enjoy the fact that you're not being hassled with right at this particular moment, and how much it sucks that everybody else is anyway, no matter how much you happen to be enjoying your life at this particular moment. If you enjoy the moments of your life, those little times when other people are going through hard stuff don't seem quite so bad at the end of it, do they? Because I think that it's our coping mechanisms are the way that we keep continuing to survive. Sounds really obvious, I know, but sometimes the obvious needs to be explained to people, because sometimes only a few people actually see it, and the rest are along for the ride. Liam Schiff is my very special guest. Welcome back to the show, bro.
Hey, Vinny. Thank you for having me back.
You're very welcome. Now, we're the third segment into it now. we were talking about ancient man, how we inbred animals, how we went into that agricultural society, and I think, what if the whole marriage phenomenon is basically just a cultural evolution phenomenon, as everybody gets more consumeristic about being attached and defensive of the things that they own, it simply starts to translate to every area of their life. Kind of like somebody who's really, really wealthy, but doesn't do any actual real work, and they tend to act like everybody else is kind of their possession because they're in their employ.
So what are you arguing, that our current marriage then, make the argument again, our current marriage relates to that how?
Well, it's talking about possession of items, right? Like, that's mine, nobody else can have it. It's the same with personal possessions and things of that nature as it is with marriage, isn't it? I mean, what's the ring about other than a sign of possession? Even hickeys themselves, for example, you know, somebody give you a hickey on the neck. Well, apparently that's like goes way, way back. And it's like a mark of ownership. If you see somebody with a hickey on their neck and you didn't put it there, it's that woman belongs to somebody else.
Right. So there are many means of ownership. Now, in a foraging culture that we talked about, which is the longest term way of our being on the planet, there seemed to be very little concept of this strict ownership. But look at that culture. There's an availability of food. There's an abundance of food. And there's a minimal amount of anxiety. There seems to be nothing resembling ongoing warfare. And there are no real possessions except what you can carry with you. That's, to Americans, probably to some Europeans, to many Australians, that probably sounds very anxiety-provoking, because we have these, you know, insulated disaster houses that we have all our DVD collections so we can remember stuff that didn't happen to us and watch it over and over again. But once you begin traveling, as I more or less have for 4 years, it feels very natural. You don't want so many possessions, and you wonder why you ever felt that you needed so many possessions. Maybe I'm in an unusual position to see this, because I did lose my partner suddenly, and I did become more of a traveling entity unto myself across this nation, and this year I hope to take off for other parts of the world, and maybe do some organic gardening. When we settled down into one spot, when we had to pass our possessions onto our kids, as you were talking about, we had to own women because we had to know that the kid was ours. Otherwise, there was something wrong. Well, that really doesn't, that's not a bother in a foraging culture, because the kids are the children of the tribe, and the children of the tribe are going to go marry into some other tribe anyway. It's not like they're going to take care of all of us when we get really old. We're all going to take care of each other. We're all going to be interwoven. We're going to bring new people into this tribe, and they're going to take care of us, and we're going to take care of them, and so on. But when you don't have anything but the state, so this is the second big change. 15,000 years ago, we changed and we became an agricultural, stably located culture, more or less. Constantly invaded by the herding cultures, the horse people, the Hun and the Khanate of Asia and Eastern Europe, or Southern Europe. And then the herding cultures, and like the Jewish culture, the Achaean, the Aryan cultures integrated through warfare, settlement, slavery, etc., with the agricultural cultures, so that by the time you birth a Greece or a Rome especially, you have a blended culture that has these onerous, patriarchal, heavy-handed notions of the herding culture, which is an extremely violent culture that has very, you know, because they're driving animals, if anything happens to the animals, they've lost their entire way of being, their livelihood, their food source, and their ability to trade. So children in those cultures are beaten. They are severely punished. The rules are extremely tense enforced through violence. Again, in a foraging culture, you don't have any of this. It's very loose. There's not, what's going to happen? You didn't pick up a grasshopper. Go pick it up. You didn't close the pen in a herding culture. The cows got away. We don't have any cows. We have to kill you, you know. So the punishments have to be more severe. The herding culture, the Jewish culture, of which I'm some sort of descendant, also took to cutting the foreskins off of males, shocking them in infancy, and making their entire sexual life part and parcel to the ownership clause of the culture. Well, this is a strange thing to do. I mean, there is genuinely no requirement to take off and bloody the foreskin of a male child, let alone a female, to take remove her labia or clitoris at a certain age. There's just no biological reason to do this. This is a system of psychological torture and ownership. This is a means of letting somebody know that they are marked their possession and putting trauma into their body at a very early age. So this happens, and we've all inherited this, you know, because the Western medical tradition, somewhere in the 1950s, 40s, decided to take this, 30s, decided to take this on. This had never been done, you know, decided to take on this strange Jewish culture, this strange, really ancient Hebrew culture, cultural tradition. It doesn't have any bearing on health or any, you know, anything like this. So we're all being marked from a young age as possession, sexual possessions of the culture. Then we rise into our adulthood. We're anxious about sex. We're told that we can like anybody that we want, but we just have to choose one. And then when we choose that one, we have to stay with them forever. Mm-hmm. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. The men have strip clubs. The men have secretaries and girlfriends and any other thing that they can get their hands on. The women have their women's gossip groups, and the women don't get the same freedoms as the men. Women are still second class, and men don't get to be free. They're told that they're in charge and it's patriarchal, but really what they have to do is become liars. And they go out on the sly and they go to the strip clubs and they have their little affair. They just need to blow off steam. They just want to kiss somebody else. It's not even a big deal. They don't really want to run away. They just, you know, they just, yeah, we don't know. Maybe they want a threesome, but they can't bring it up, so they go and do a onesome somewhere else. Now, women have sexual needs, too. They don't get them met. They bury it in resentment and anxiety and anger and overmanagement and terrible, terrible jealousy. And this is what I see in the culture. This is the book I was writing. But what I wrote was the personal story, a very loving, funny story of how I figured out personally that I wasn't really... Now, I exaggerated some things. It's fictionalized, so I took liberties with that, so you don't know everything about me. But there it is in the truth about love, how to find your more than one. And that's on Amazon. It's 99 cents right now. Please go buy a copy if you want to hear some funny, interesting stories about how guys talk about sex, if you're a female and you want to actually hear that. But the end of this story is that we end up with a marriage system that's based totally on the idea that men are supposed to somehow be a housebund, a house owner. That's all it means. You're the house owner, housebund, husband. And the wife is the property thereof. That's it. That's the whole story. That's what it is. Now we have feminism, and feminism has sought to make women equal in a system of slavery. Men go to a job that they hate.
We're still working out the kinks, ladies and gentlemen. Don't worry. Don't worry. They'll be performing live on the network next week. That's if you actually know of the band The Kinks, for which that incredibly crummy joke was made just now. You listen to The Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and we're live 4 nights a week for your listening eargasm pleasure. And just remember, if you don't get enough eargasms during the week, you're probably going to have to supplement a few with The Vinnie Eastwood Show. All right, it's just for your sexual and brain health. We'll be right back after the break. Thank you very much for listening. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand, live from the future, in the sunny slave South Pacific island jewel paradise, where nothing ever goes wrong, and it's so totally free of corruption that we've only got like 120 high court justices, and about 106 of them are related by first cousin at least. It's really good place if you want to get, you know, a bad judicial corruption overturned and stuff. Let me put it that way. My very special guest is Liam Sheff. Welcome back, son.
Thank you, Father.
Yeah.
What were we talking about?
Well, we were talking about how we got into our current situation in society and the point where the feminism movement came in to help everybody become equal, equal slaves.
Right. So, but how did we get there? We were an agricultural society. We walked through the Middle Ages, the Roman era, the Middle Ages, and everything was more or less the same. Somewhere in the 1700s, 1800s, it was clear we were headed in a different direction. We seemed to be headed up. And the age of metal gave way to the age of machines. I mean, if we had, you know, bronze and iron and then and suddenly we had steel and moving parts, we had massively increased the amount of energy that was available to us by digging in the ground. First, we started to use coal instead of, which created huge health problems all over Europe, especially in the compacted cities, in London famously. But we started using coal because it was a compacted form of, you know, carbons, wood, or plant material, and we could burn this and get much more heat out of it. The heat was so intense, actually, that we could boil water and move. If we could machine something to be pressed inside of a vessel, well, we'll call it a piston, right? So you boil the water and then you drive the piston with the steam. Then we could move things, wheels. We entered this industrial age because of coal. Coal didn't run low. Whaling oil ran low. But in digging for coal, people found a slippery sort of coal, and they called it rock oil. And they decided that this might be a good replacement for whale oil for lamps, because they were killing all the whales. Whales used to be so numerous. There was a sketch or something in the Boston area that you could, you know, walk across one of the little inlets on the whaleback, you know, to an island in the bay. No more. You know, those days are long gone. Those animals were used for lighting candles or lighting lamps. That's how careful a species we are.
We have a blogger called Whale Oil, and he's really, really tight with the Prime Minister, sends private texts back and forth, and then releases information to the public that the Prime Minister doesn't want to do himself because it looks too dirty. But unfortunately, somebody hacked his email account and found out all the dirt. And then, of course, he gets a popularity boost in the ratings and gets re-elected. You got to love that.
Yeah, anyway. Politics is always the same. It's always who you know and who you blow. So that's always, it's always that way. It's always who you know and what you're willing to do for them and what you're willing to hide for them. That's always the case. It's been that way since the emperors of Rome were being assassinated by their Praetorian guards, or their wives were plotting to kill to kill them.
Wasn't it mafiosos of Sicily or something like that came up with a system of dons and Corleones, and I don't think Corleone is actually a particular name of a don, but where they could basically rule things without ever participating in any of the crimes that are done, right? And they get complete lack of accountability, more or less, just by having underlings do all the dirty business for them and keeping their hands clean. And that seems to be like the perfect ruling model that seems to be used today by whoever the heck is in charge of anything. You never see them doing the dirty work themselves.
It's not necessary. You know, people want to be associated with power, so they're willing to do the stuff for them. And the term will pop to people's mind. It's plausible deniability, and that's what they always want. But how did we get from this ownership culture of women to this crazed situation in which we all seem to be running our lives on phones? And the answer is oil. Oil popped up in the 1800s, and by 1901 or 2 became the significant driving force in the Western world. Was discovered.
Naturally, because the Rockefellers' Standard Oil wiped out all competition in the oil production industry, and then also destroyed all the places where you could refuel things with ethanol after they financed the prohibition of alcohol, which meant all the people that were growing their own plant matter and making ethanol out of it and fueling their cars on that could no longer do it because ethanol was made illegal under the prohibition of alcohol. So thank you! Thank you, Rockefeller.
Well done. Very clever. Very true. Nevertheless, oil would have won the day because there was more of it. And it's harder to produce the volume of corn or any kind of sugar-based ethanol.
They were mostly using hemp, which produced about four times the amount of it. And Henry Ford actually built Ford cars out of hemp that were lighter and stronger hemp fuel.
You can do it, but you can't do it. You can't do it at the for a billion cars around the world, which is what exists.
And you certainly can't do it if it's illegal, because the people who own the law made it so.
No, I agree, and I want to agree with you that it's possible to run some vehicles on this. But what we discovered, but what the human species discovered, was a surfeit, an abundance of this stuff that can't be replaced by plant matter on Earth. So if we're making the argument that this stuff was made illegal, it was. That there was a monopoly, there was. That there were illegal practices to put other groups out of business, there were. But it would have happened one way or the other because there was so much oil. And oil is worth a volume of energy, especially in the early days when it was being discovered. When you drilled a well and you got 100,000 barrels a day, per day, a barrel of oil being worth a certain amount of heat. That amount of heat is called 5.8 million British thermal units, which is the amount of energy it takes to raise a pound of water, I think, a degree. But 5.8 million British thermal units is the equivalent of 23,000 hours of human labor. 23,000 hours is about 1,000, call it 1,000 days, not quite, which is about 2.7 years. So a barrel of oil is worth 2.7 years of human labor, slave labor. They're constant, 24-hour a day, you know, so make that a day job, 8 hours a day, divided into 8 hour days, times three.
Call 20, that, 21 years.
Call that, 2.7 times three, call it 10. It's not quite 10. Call it seven and something. Call it 8 years. So let's say, that, and you take off
call
weekends,
it, it call doesn't it matter. There's no freaking way you could do as much work as that oil does.
We use 19 million barrels of that 2.7 years. Per day in my country alone, this country, which is the equivalent of 50 million years of slave labor per day. And if you ask, how is that possible? Go look at any highway, any interstate. There are thousands of cars pointlessly, uselessly rolling their couple thousand pounds of steel along. Those thousands of pounds of steel were hammered in forges using oil. They were shipped. The rubber in the tires is, of course, not from rubber trees, but it's oil. The material that's being shipped are vegetables that come from Monsanto land in the middle of the country. That's all fed from oil and pesticides and glyphosate. The fertilizers are anhydrous ammonium, which are derived from gasoline, which is an oil derivative. The airplanes taking things across the country for UPS or the trucks for Amazon.com are all running on gasoline and oil, which is all from oil. So we use 50 million years of slave labor, but it's not true because no matter how many slaves you have, you can't fly an airplane 35,000 feet in the air. You can't do it. So what we have is an impossible system built on the weakest ledge, the weakest branch, the longest branch of a tree, as far out as you can go. We put the heaviest civilization that's ever existed, and it's being fueled by the tiniest, thinnest line of oil coming from Mexico, Saudi Arabia, the Caspian Sea, and now we're fracking. And we're fracking because these surfeits, these abundance is coming from Texas and Saudi Arabia and Mexico, Venezuela, are in decline, and they've been in decline. That's why we're blowing up the ground now to get the remaining greasy rock, and that's what we're going to be doing for the next 15 years. After that, we decline into a low oil state. And I don't think that we feed 7 billion people on Monsanto land. And I think things begin to look a lot different. And the funny liberals who are talking about whatever they're talking about on the Huffington Post pages just go away. And the conservative, there will be wars, but, you know, they'll become increasingly local because it's hard to fund an international war when you're low on oil. Ask Rommel. That's why he lost in the desert. He didn't have oil. The Germans didn't have oil in World War II. They had to negotiate coal. They had to superheat coal with liquid and turn it into a kind of oil, but it wasn't really the same quality as the Americans were getting from Texas. And then when we made the deal with Saudi Arabia that funded the great so-called American, you know, renaissance of the 1950s, that's when we became the world power, because we sucked on the straw coming across the sea from Saudi Arabia, and we had Texas in our back pocket anyway. Well,
that, and they were the only power that wasn't bombed into the frickin' Stone Age. and also, incidentally, did you know the United States embargoed oil and hemp from the Philippines going to the Empire of Japan? And that's allegedly what provoked the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Very good, yeah. No, I mean, the attack on Pearl Harbor was to stop the American fleet from interrupting the Japanese from getting oil exactly as you said, from the South Pacific, because they don't have any oil in Japan. And if they're going to be an international force to be reckoned with in the 20th century, they needed oil. Well, they didn't have it, so they bombed the fleet, and strangely, they didn't bomb the oil reserves, so the Americans were able to go. There were all these, you know, containers of oil there. Big ones. I don't know what they're called, but these very, 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 very large ground containers, and they didn't bomb those. So the American fleet was able to just rebuild itself because we had so much bloody oil. We could do it. If you have oil, you can do millions of years of labor in days. That's the way it is now. When we don't have that, everything's going to look really different. So what does this have to do with relationships? People argue, and there's a movie coming out called Monogamish, and there's a whole sort of intellectual, slightly airy-fairy, head-in-the-clouds movement. And, you know, I'm sympathetic with it because I'm openly not monogamous. I don't sleep with, you know, I don't go around running around having sex. I have actual meaningful relationships, but I don't claim to own anybody's genitals because I care about them. We actually converse about what we're going to do. We talk about it. But what does this have to do with relationships? There's a movement now to make people free to have more open relationships. But when we don't have millions of years of slave labor growing food for us, everything radically shifts. And this is something that nobody in the country is talking about. And in my next book, I will be talking about this. We will be entering a period, if we get to it, with 100, I mean, in this North American, in my country, we've got 104, I think, nuclear reactors that might be about right. All of them are old. Any number of them have problems. The one in South Florida, it could go critical because it's just so old and the water, the heating system is so bad. There's one in New Mexico that's been having a leak, an explosive problem, something going on for months. There's Fukushima leaking, I think, 6 nuclear reactors worth of tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of highly radioactive, hot, volatile, molten material into the Pacific Ocean. There is an animal, a mammal die-off and a crustacean die-off going on in Hawaii, Seattle, Pacific Northwest, and there are sea lions washing up on the shore dead in Malibu.
Apparently, some reports said that those sea lions were washing up without their skin, like it had been melted off or something.
I didn't see that one, but they're dying and they're starving, and they have strange diseases.
Radiation, mate. Oh my God. There's like a laundry list of diseases that get caused by radiation exposure.
That's it. And the virologists who run the government, because virologists have never gotten anything right. As a friend of mine pointed out, why do we trust virologists? You know, they got the swine flu wrong. They blamed polio on a stomach bug, and then while they were spraying people with DDT to kill flies, I mean, they literally blame polio. This is in Official Stories, my book. It's available on Amazon too. They blame polio on a stomach bug that they never purified. It comes out in your poop. It doesn't get into your nervous system or cause any kind of this neurological thing. They sprayed DDT on people because they said that people were getting sick from flies. So they sprayed them with DDT. They were using lead and arsenic on fruits and vegetables as fungicides to kill things, you know, pestilences, so that they could ship them a long distance into the cities. People would eat these things, have neurological, you know, apoplexies and paralyses. And then they said that they had, you know, some sort of poliomyelitis. Well, you know, that this was caused by some invisible thing. I guess arsenic is invisible at a certain level. I suppose lead is invisible at a certain level, and then sometimes it's not. They like to blame viruses for what are toxicological, and now they're going to blame viruses for what are radiological. They're going to actually go one better than that. They're going to blame global warming for the mass die-off of creatures in the Pacific, although you could argue that there would be more life in the Pacific in a slightly warmer ocean. You know, you can't really make this argument. But radiation, as you said, will cause every disease because it causes the unraveling of DNA and RNA. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, structurally, biological life forms can't hold together and they fall apart. And when they fall apart, they're eaten by every scavenger in the environment.
Well, what the guys who were studying the effect of intravenous vitamin C's on viruses basically found out is that all viral infections at their core are only possible because of the loss of electrons in your cells dying and making them more susceptible to disease. And so if you've got something like high dose intravenous vitamin C being pumped in there, it prevents electron theft by these kind of creatures, and you basically don't get sick. And if you are sick and you're getting this stuff being pumped into you, you get better.
And very often that's the case, but nothing gets you better from polonium. And this is now what's, you know, polonium in the in cesium 137.
I thought polonium was a kind of breakfast sausage.
It's a breakfast cereal in Poland.
Oh no! It's what you put on your kitchen floor in Poland.
Yeah, polonium.
It's like Polish linoleum. It's Polish linoleum.
I believe it's the radioactive element named after Poland for Marie Curie, but I might be wrong. Oh no, she would be French.
Plutonium, named after the Roman god of the underworld, Pluto. You know, because it's so freaking dangerous. And heaps of that stuff's coming out anyway. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Liam Chef is my guest. It's not spelt the same as the regular chef and the people with the hats, though. We'll be right back. Okay, let's bring it down, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting on American Freedom Radio. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast, so if you would like to protect yourself from nasty EMF and wireless radiation frequencies of 4G and smart meters and, oh my God, there's so much stuff in the air, bro, it's unbelievable. Get yourself a blue shield. All right, go to the homepage of thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y because it's the most important question. Eastwood doesn't go ahead, make my news. And click on the little blue shield banners and everything there and get yourself one of those puppies. Sort you out. Other than that, it's donations primarily, which have been supporting me and paying on my bills since about 2012. So I'm really kind of dedicated myself full time. I just sort of launched myself into it without a plan B sort of thing to make sure that New Zealand activists have a voice and somebody to go to the protests and film and upload their stuff and interview them on air, that kind of thing, because nobody was really doing that to any great degree. And if they were doing it, it was once in a while, or they get a sound bite on the news or something. Mate, these people can talk for hours and give you incredible information. Nobody was giving it to them. So I took personal responsibility for the situation and give it to them. So please go to my homepage, thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, and make a donation today. And if you really, really like the really, really extensive quantity of guests and different topics that I bring on this, start up for a regular donation as well. Just a couple of dollars a month pays everything that you see here and allows me to have decent equipment so I can go out and do a good job for the people who don't have that kind of skills or resources at hand. You know, you've got to serve humanity somehow. And this is how I do it. Everybody else has got their own ways as well, which are nonetheless valuable. Like Liam Chef, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. I was enjoying listening to that. It's people don't realize it's actually hard to ask for money. You know, you have to sort of go, okay, I guess I have to do this. To keep things happening, I have to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I sometimes will go months being really uncomfortable in terms of, like, financially, just paying things off, and, you know, down to the wire, last minute or whatever. It's only if I'm completely screwed and I've got no choice that I'll really ask people for money.
Speaking of that, you can get my book on Amazon.com. It's 99 cents. It's called The Truth About Love. A novel about finding your more than one. Please do support Vinny. You know, it's nice to throw 10. What is your money monetary? Is it a dollar, New Zealand dollar?
You can donate in US dollars, actually.
Okay. So I recommend going to the PayPal. Is that what you use, PayPal?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and if you happen to be in New Zealand, there's a New Zealand bank account number there as well for all of those people. So it kind of cuts both ways. And this way, I've actually got multiple sources of income. So I've got the New Zealanders donating into my New Zealand account, the Americans donating into my PayPal, which transfers into my New Zealand account, obviously. And I've got the Google AdSense on my YouTube videos, which is providing an income into my New Zealand account on a monthly basis as well.
I mean, do you get enough hits from that? You need
it,
what?
It pays for about 1 week's rent out of every month.
It's phenomenal. How many videos do you have to have, and what are the numbers that you have to have to make that work? I know we're changing the subject, but
3,000 videos, give or take 3.4 million hits over a 5-6 year period on that channel.
So you're dedicated 18,000
subscribers.
You produce a show, a video for every show you do.
Pretty much, and in some cases like multiple, so you can watch part 1 through 6 or whatever. I haven't really been doing that lately because it's kind of time consuming to do that.
So this is what you do, and you're fully dedicated to making these videos and formatting them, and that's why you're saying that you're depressed about your computer, because you lost some work.
Well, it turns out that I haven't actually lost the work. I just have to do a little bit of more work to retrieve it, is the thing, and that's kind of the thing. So I'm not like, oh dude, you should have seen me the last 24 hours, mate. It was, yeah,
right.
I really wasn't my cheery self. I was, you know how sometimes you've been through this, haven't you? When something you love just is lost and you know that it's not coming back, or at least you're pretty freaking sure that it's not coming back, and suddenly there is weight upon every single inch of your body. It's so hard to move. It's even harder to breathe, and so difficult to think really at all as you sit there in that limbo region, not knowing whether this thing that's really important to you is alive or dead in that moment. It's almost like you wish that you couldn't have that benefit of a possibility. If the possibility was retracted, then you have to instantly start dealing with it. But when you speculate and you start thinking about how much work went into that and what you're really, really losing before knowing whether or not you've lost it, you can do a lot of damage to yourself. And I did.
What did you do? You didn't punch a door and break your hand, did you?
No. Just mostly sat around and mopey, you know?
Okay.
I'm not, like, I can either get really angry or really mopey. The Incredible Hulk or the Incredible Sulk. That's basically about it.
The Incredible Sulk strikes again.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump back into the end of this spiel, if that is acceptable.
The chef spiel.
All right. When we got oil, we essentially got permanent slavery. At least we thought it was permanent, and nobody's ever really thought about what would happen if we ran low on this stuff. There are a number of myths out there, like there's a Tesla machine that will instantly plug into the existing degraded grid. This is a myth. This is fiction. We already use Tesla machines. We use AC generators, and we use electrical motors, which are essentially the inverse of an AC generator. So we use Tesla all the time. He was a weapons manufacturer toward the end of his career, and he never really built anything that was of use to the military. He tried to sell, you know, directed beam energy, but he couldn't do it because, you know, he just ended up with this diffuse bit of electromagnetic output that fills the sky and crackles. He had ideas. He electrocuted himself through his career, by the way. He thought that more electricity was good for him, so he slowly went crazy. I know that the conspiracy world likes to imagine that anything is possible, but not anything is possible. Now, you can argue with me with this. It's fine. You can send me the stuff. You know, go to my Facebook page and send me some good data. I'll read it. I'm not opposed to reading it, but I've never seen anything that made me think that there was a magic machine that would plug into the existing degraded grid that's not even worldwide. It's degraded in the places that it was put in the 1950s. You know, we've got huge problems facing us that will not be solved. And I genuinely predict a significant reduction in the size of the human species on planet Earth by 2050. I don't mean by the end of the 2100s, maybe by, you know, 2050, I think that we'll be beginning to see the slide back down to a manageable number of people. And as we do that, you're going to see people wondering how to hold on to structure. You'll have coal in some areas, you'll have oil in some areas, you'll have a less available abundance of food. Food will have to be increasingly localized. There'll be huge problems in getting there. There'll be, you know, I think there'll be ugly cataclysms. There'll be people who feel that you could, fight your way through a revolution to get through it, and that the power structure has all the answers. But I don't know how to tell you, but these ancient kings of Europe are just really stupid. They're
people are like going, oh, it's going to be combat, it's going to be combat. Dude, do you realize, you know, most of the people that die in a war are civilians? B, most of the soldiers that die in war die before they even see a day in combat. They die of simple common diseases and things like that. Half the time they don't even get to the battlefield. Their ship gets sunk or something like that, bro. I mean, it's like there are so many things that you die from in war that don't even have anything to do with war.
Well said. I have such a hard time talking with the conspiracy crowd over in my part of the world, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's just like they haven't gone camping enough, you know, that they don't.
They don't know the front line, back line situation. Okay, like in any war, there are two lines. There's the front where you're killing and dying and so on and so forth, and then there's the back where you're commanding, patching up broken soldiers, manufacturing machines to go out and fight the wars, setting up camps, and basically these are the safety nets essentially, without which the front line would die pretty freaking quickly and pretty freaking ruthlessly. A lot of people are thinking in frontline attack, attack, attack mentality without thinking about the backline, what's going to happen after you've attacked and you're injured and there's nobody around to heal you up and patch you up for the next mission.
Right. And war isn't something that you can conduct unless you have the resources to conduct it. And you can look at something like World War One to see how this turns out. Mm-hmm. Right. So the idea that we're going to be saved from above by the Tesla, you know, army of super machines is not something I really understand.
I don't know about you, Liam, but I don't subscribe to the theory that there's like hope of, a victory without great sacrifice, great suffering, great pain. I assume that I'll get what I want, but likewise assume that I will have to suffer immensely and may not survive before I get it.
There's that. I don't assume that we do get what we want. I assume that the human species grinds itself back down to a manageable number of people through a number of means that a number of realities that we haven't encountered yet, because we're still sucking on off the fat of Monsanto land. You know, we still have all of this massive surfeit producing, but we a surfeit of oil producing fake food. Mm. When that dwindles and we have to do it locally, I don't know how people look or how healthy or unhealthy they are in your part of the world, but I can tell you here over in Walmart land, people are extraordinarily unhealthy. They have no idea how to work together. They don't know how to cooperate or how to manage nature. Nature is terrifying to them. You know, this is really the world that we now live in. It's a very terrifying world that you have to kill everything and spray everything and so on and so forth.
It reminds me of the most recent episode of The Walking Dead when they, spoiler alert if whoever's listening, they waltz into a town where everybody's like happy and everything's fine. And they're like, you know, there's all the comforts of home here. We're going to get weak, you know, like these people here who haven't been outside the walls, who haven't had that trauma and suffering and what have you. And that's what comfort and convenience does to you, I think, overwhelmingly, is it weakens you.
Right. Well, we're incredibly weak and we don't have any idea how to function. We don't know how to be foragers. We don't know how to be farmers. And we don't even know how to be herders. I see a relapse into old-time religion, into Jesus land. There'll be a lot, you know, when things go bad, there's always talk about how Jesus is going to come and kill us all and then save us or whatever that story is. The second and third coming will definitely, you know, be given, sequels. That's essentially where I see us going. So why did I write a story about love? Well, because the human species I don't think that we were really built to live this way. It's almost a mistake in my mind that we stumbled upon oil. And my greatest hope is that we manage to end up in something that resembles something somewhere between the 17th and the 18th century. That would be my great, as difficult as it was, that would be my, and as many problems
little
as
house on
were.
The prairie type thing, you know, simple steam technology if you're lucky.
Well, no, I mean, you know, the Victorian era in cities was You know, you had some sewage and you had some problems with that. Of course, you had great syphilis epidemics in London. You had more prostitutes.
Well, that was because of the royal family. When, in fact, that's still going on today.
No. If you want to convince yourself that everything we've been told about sex is just a huge lie, read about Victorian London. Victorian, you know, which is supposedly synonymous with uptight and nobody doing anything untoward.
Polish your knob, Governor.
Right. Yes, exactly. More prostitutes, you know, from Georgian to Victorian London. The only reason it got cleaned up in our minds was because Queen Victoria had to write the perception of her family, which were the Hanoverians, the Germans. She had to write the perception of her family as, you know, knob polishing so-and-sos.
Yeah, French knob polishers.
I think they were German, as German knob polishers. So she just...
It seems really exotic all of a sudden. Go ahead.
So she decided that even though she had, I think, was it 13 or 7 to 13? I'm mixing her with Maria Therese. She probably had 7.
Oh, we're coming to break anyway. And we were talking about sequels before, bro, you know, like King Henry VIII or the Ninth or whatever the heck it was, you know. And then, like, there's these movies coming out, like there was Divergent, and now this year coming out Insurgent, and the third sequel is going to be called Detergent. It's going to be really awesome. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live 4 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And I think also that I have a number of affiliates, so depending on where you are, what time of the day you're up, allegedly the people in the UK have to listen from like 3 till 5 a.m. You know what's interesting about that time of the morning? That's basically the time of the morning that I started on American Freedom Radio, local time in New Zealand, you know. And I did that for 6 months. Oi, that could be testing. Speaking of testing, my very special guest, Liam Sheff, is still here.
Speaking of testes.
Did I say testes?
I love the bits you're playing. I don't know if it's American Freedom Radio. Who's playing the Carlin and the Hicks between... These are great segments.
Oh, well, I think we've all kind of like pitched in little things or everything, but you can basically just put it down to the network owner, Danny.
Well, that's fun stuff. I mean, I couldn't... Sometimes George Carlin is overwhelming in an hour or 90-minute set, but his single points are so salient. You know, I mean, he's sort of a novelist of American hypocrisy, you know, writing on stage. And then there's Bill Hicks just telling so much truth, much more probably than he even knew. I mean, I'm sure he doubted sometimes if he was being too hard. Maybe he didn't. But, you know, if you're a critic, if you're a cultural critic, you're also a human being. And you wonder if you're being too hard on people because they're only people after all. And one of the things I was saying before was, we always talk about how evil people are, and I think I always love when people tell me how, you know, what geniuses the people in charge are. I think they're not that smart. You know, they get suckered by the scientists who come along, and the scientists are suckered by their, you know, priesthood professors who tell them that this is what they have to do.
We're just this
strange religious culty animal that continues down this path. But we got oil, and we're able to do millions of years of labor and hours. Really, truly, millions of years of labor in hours. That's the kind of energy we have at our fingertips, and that's what we're able to perform now, so that you can explode nuclear suns all over continents and do whatever you want anywhere, and you can make glass into a flat surface that's electron sensitive, so you can touch it and move a little fake bird around, and you could think that that's progress. I don't understand it. That's not progress. That has nothing to do. There's really no progress in the technological era. We've just had more energy to make tools with. When the energy recedes, we'll be back to making tools that don't require oil energy. But we don't. It's going to have to come back through hard labor. We came up through the Middle Ages developing all of this manageable technology. It's all gone. For centuries, it's gone. We don't have anything that we can run. by ourselves with, there's very little that runs on water power. There's we've got very little solar. We're deeply, profoundly screwed. And
you see one power cut in a major urban center, nobody has anything to do. They can't do anything.
Right. Period. I'm so glad that you understand this because, you know, if I were on some of the American channels, I'd be having a large argument about how the power structure is holding back the Tesla coil. And I just think, look, read Nikola Tesla's work, read his life. We use Tesla energy all the time. It's called the AC generator and the electric motor. They're the same machine backwards. That's what he did. He was a genius. That's what he did. Newton didn't invent gravity. He just described it. That's what he did. He didn't understand electromagnetism. We're only human beings. We have limits. And if you start bringing in the Anunnaki and all this other stuff, okay, all right. But, you know, you might as well talk about Harry Potter because this is where we live. And we live in a society that's, again, put out on the furthest branch, the furthest, longest, most fragile branch of the on the tallest tree. And it's the heaviest civilization that's ever existed, and it's only being propped up by this little stream of oil that runs all the machines that sort of keep it propelled keep the propellers spinning. And when those machines run out, we just fall. When the bow breaks, the cradle will fall. That's where we're headed. I don't have any solutions at all except get the bloody hell out of the cities. Figure out how to farm and garden, figure out what permaculture is, and don't think that you're going to keep a shotgun and that's going to protect you from the millions of people you live with. Yeah. It's not.
You're going to have to become like a barbarian raiding party or something of that nature. You know, wearing animal skins and breaking into villages, pilfering booty and things of Absolutely. That nature. I mean, essentially it'll be back in the day, lawlessness to a large degree, the survival of the fittest, except we'll have remnants of advanced technology lying around. Now, bullets don't last forever. Petrol has a use-by date. So if things really, really do go south, there'll only be like pockets of humanity that'll be able to live relatively carefree existences, and the rest is basically just going to die off by one means or the other.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know if people are just totally adverse to this conversation on a regular basis, but I'm trying to be an historian rather than a fantasist. And if you understand how civilizations decline, or how they rebound and become something else, you have to look at the Khanate of Asia. You have to look at the horse culture of Asia, the Hun and the Khan. And you have to ask yourself if that's where you want to live or if you would just adapt. Human beings are surprisingly adaptable. They'll eat almost anything. I predict that in dire emergencies, cannibalism will become... in fact, I'm thinking of calling a chapter of my new book Soylent Green as People, and it's not that bad.
That sounds appetizing.
All right, just waiting.
Yeah, have like a recipe book or something, bro.
As a vegetarian, of course, I'll be running for the hills. They'll eat me first. But I don't predict a happy ending for the human species, even though I'm writing a book about love and I'm going to write another novel about another sort of fictionalized part of my life, because I like to, because I'm an artist, because I'm a writer, because I'm poetic. That's why I'm doing it. We're a poetical species, but we didn't, to use this word, however I'm using it, evolve. We didn't come around with the amount of resources and energy that we now have in this brief millisecond of human history. And when it goes away, we're going to forget that this happened. I genuinely feel that in my gut. We will absolutely, I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow, but it will happen eventually, and that is the prognosis for this civilization. Yay!
You know, it is quite a nasty thing when you think about it, about what can happen in society, but, you know, just keep your sense of humor about it, and there's two pieces of survival equipment that people don't really realize that they desperately need. One is something you can never leave behind, and it's always with you, your brain. If you keep thinking and you use that to govern your actions, you might survive. And the other that a lot of people don't think about is in terms of survival gear, something that's going to run out that you're really going to want, toilet paper, bro. You know,
and toilet paper and disposable razors. You know, you want to, yeah.
And you were talking about the cannibalism before, and I was at a Splore Music Festival not too long ago, and I was doing recordings with my megaphone and just playing them. Here's one of them.
Please drink lots of water and be kind to other people. You may have to eat them later.
You know, the Mayan civilization was one of many on Earth that devolved into cannibalism because perhaps they had run out of protein sources in the jungle because they were overpopulated. We get all of our food. You know, I was a vegetarian. I guess I still am, but I was a vegetarian for a long time thinking that it was healthier. And I guess it was a little healthier than, well, it was a lot healthier than eating factory farm food. But I've now become aware of the fact that this is just another commoditized thing. It's a genetically modified, you know, fake food market. And I don't go and buy soy the way I used to. I'm very cautious about it now. It's not that I think soy is evil. It's that I think it's all genetically bloody modified.
Yeah. And I really like English muffins for breakfast sometimes. And my wife and I go into the supermarket. It was just, you know, like she now like looks at all these things. Ah, it's got soy. It's got soy. It's got soy. It was like, damn it. Everything's got soy. There's no such thing as muffins for me anymore.
Or the wheat. The wheat, they don't, it's not genetically modified, but they dry it with glyphosate. They dry it with Roundup. These bastards, you maniacs, you blew it up.
It's kind of like those freaking scumbags that thimerosal, the mercury in the vaccines, and they say now, oh, we don't have mercury in the vaccines anymore. We don't have any thimerosal. Really? Do you still have it while you're processing it in the first place, but don't just add it later as a preservative into the vaccine, but it's still got stuff in it anyway? Well, yeah, we do that. Then you're stretching the truth, you hair-splitting son of a biatch.
And how much aluminum have you replaced the thimerosal with? You know, it's an equal part of aluminum now, or a double.
Probably just enough aluminum to make it give you Alzheimer's and forget that you got vaccinated.
Speaking of this great push against the anti-vaxxers, there's such an obvious and blatant huge movement on to make all anti-vax people seem like maniacal scumbags who are going to destroy the world. But the real plot, I think, is that there's just a massive attempt to weaken and minimize the human species. The people in charge, even though I said they're not geniuses, somebody's up there going, look, there's 7 billion of us. We're running out of the Ogallala Aquifer in the middle of the North American continent is draining. And the Central Valley's been in drought for years, and it's not coming back. So what can we do? What can we do?
All right, let's
inject everybody with poison.
All right.
Let's inject everybody with poison.
We're going to be coming to break real soon, Liam, so if you want to wrap up.
I want to wrap up. I want to thank you for having me on. I had a really good time, and I'm grateful to you. And if I can push my book about all of these, I think, very real conspiracies, that is a grounded book. It's called Official Stories, Counter Arguments for a Culture in Need. It's 10 topics, 11 chapters, and I think you'll enjoy it. It's full of laughs. And I'm careful with my information. I think that you'll feel it's very earthy and grounded. And this very sweet book about really loving my partner and still not being very monogamous and walking through that journey is called The Truth About Love. And it's there on Amazon under my name, Liam Sheff. And I'd be grateful if you'd pick them up on Kindle. They're both cheap, deadly cheap right now.
And that's Sheff, S-C-H-E-F-F, like a chef school, you know? It's spelled like school, but ends in the chef.
It's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. You make that work for you. Now, also, I wanted to remind people, yet again, listener-supported broadcast. So please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, start up your regular donations today, $5 a month, coming in to those things that keeps all the bills paid here. And we've got, you know, I've got a wife to support. She's starting up her gardening business and all of that kind of thing. Times are tough and tight for everybody. So that's why I appreciate everybody's contributions, no matter how big, no matter how small. It's all very, very much appreciated, all very much needed. And you know that I'll never be able to repay you. You're only donating for something that I've probably already done. Gotten on a great guest, helped you have a little bit of knowledge or something of that line. It'd be quite nice, wouldn't it? It's so nice to be live on radio. I love American Freedom Radio. I'm so glad that it's back. So glad that it's back. See you again sometime, folks.